Welcome to the Blackhawks Talk Podcast. I am Pat Boyle with Charlie Romeliotis. And on this episode, we catch up with the coach who knows Patrick Kane better than anyone, Darryl Belfry. He's been working with Kane since he was just 9 years old. What has that process been like? We get into the summer pro camps that Belfry holds with the likes of Kane, Matthews, and Giroux. And what current things is he working on with Kane? And how long does Belfry think Kane can play in the NHL? It's all coming up on the Blackhawks Talk Podcast.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Born in the Rockies, Coors Light is lagered cold for a crisp, clean taste. Filtered cold to ensure clarity and brightness. And packaged cold for peak refreshment. Because those who thirst for more deserve the world's most refreshing beer.
Joining us now is Darryl Belfry. His new book, Belfry Hockey, Strategies to Teach the World's Best Athletes. He wrote it with our friend Scott Powers from The Athletic, and Patrick Kane wrote the foreword. First of all, Darryl, congratulations. Let's start with your start in hockey, because it wasn't a traditional path. How did you embark on this career as a hockey skills development coach or a consultant?
Well, think of like the worst possible start someone could have in any career. So like uneducated, can't skate, can't handle a puck, can't shoot, can't really do it. No playing career. That's how I started. So it's literally like the bottom. So when I started, I had just finished like playing, and I use that term very loosely. I finished, I was like 18 years old, but I didn't get a traditional start with most kids. They start when they're 4 or 5 years old. I didn't start playing until I was 12. So it was very fast for me to play. I was playing and then it felt like a blink and it was over. But I still had so much passion for the game and wanted to keep playing. So I wanted to keep in the game somehow. So then I started to embark upon the idea of coaching. And then ultimately, through that process, realized that there's a big difference between coaching and teaching. And I perhaps fall more on the side of teaching, which is much more personal and individual. And as the years went by, I found myself gravitating more and more to opportunities that allowed me to teach. And that's kind of how it blossomed.
What was the process like of writing this book? And how did the idea kind of spark? Like, you know what, I actually want to sit down and do this.
I think like initially I had several people like come to me that were like young people that were trying to get into skill development. And they're like, hey, Darryl, can you give us any insight on, you know, your path? And, you know, is there anything that we could model or anything like that? And, you know, it didn't feel like a very short conversation. There's just so many layers to it. And I had thought at times, you know, maybe I should just write it all down and that might be the easiest way to do it. And so I'd approached Scott Powers probably 5 years ago and said, hey, like, I'm going to need somebody. I'm thinking about writing a book. I'm going to need someone to help me with that. Is that something you'd be interested in? And, he said, yeah, just let me know when you're ready. And of course it took like 4 years after that to kind of get to a place where I felt like I had the time and I really had it wrapped around my brain of what I wanted to do. But the process I thought was daunting. Like initially I was like, I don't know if I can sit down and actually write it. And so I came up with this idea that I was going to like build out a map of what I thought the book should be. From a chapter perspective and all the things I felt like should go into it. And then I'm just going to shoot an audio file because I can talk way faster than I can write. And I felt like it just bogged me down. And so I said, Scott, like, if I just sent you these audio files, can you convert that then into written word? And he's like, well, yeah, we can do that. That's no problem. And I'm like, well, if I knew that, I probably would have done this way earlier, because I thought it was like this great, big, daunting process. And it turns out there's professionals who can actually do this stuff.
Well, we've heard about you for years now because of your association with Patrick. And, you know, I think initially most of us thought it was something that came about midway through his NHL career, and didn't realize that it started when he was age 9. When he first walks into that rink and you begin to work with him at age 9, did you have any idea that you were with a potential future Hall of Famer?
No, I mean, the problem was when he first started, the rules in the NHL were very different and the style of play was very different. It wasn't really built for a guy like him. And then when they had the first lockout, and they basically like went to players like him that they wanted to be able to include in the game, that it was obviously precluding from a skill perspective, just the clutch and grab and all of that sort of stuff. It was like he wrote the rules, like, hey, if you were to be successful in this league, how would it be? And it was like he wrote them. And then you start to see, yeah, there's a path for a kid like this. And I think it became exciting from more from that time forward. I think most of us just thought, no, this is a really skilled player. He's going to be an unbelievable college player. That's how we were thinking, of course, because the really skilled, like smaller players, it was hard on them, like really hard on them. And then when it changed, it was like, wait a minute, there might be not only room for him, but he could really excel. And that's what happened.
Well, and to that point, like when you begin working with him, you know, enforcers were the norm in the NHL to protect highly skilled guys. And you had to turn in and make one of the kids that was a defenseman, and you made him, I think, the centerman, and he was out there sort of to protect Patrick.
Yeah. Like when we were going through, our team was a team from a very small geographical area relative to the teams in which we were playing against. And we would go into Toronto and you're playing against 10 of the top 15 scorers in the league in all the GTA, and you're now playing. And so we didn't certainly have the depth that other teams had. And so Patrick, of course, was a key player on our team and was generating a lot of offense. And for years he was like dangling people, multiple people going to the net. And then all of a sudden, you know, the introduction of body contact came in, and it was like, you remember that kid that, you know, that was dangling everybody and embarrassing everybody scoring. Well, now you can hit him. And so people were taking hefty runs and coming after him. And Patrick was like undersized, was meant like also like really small and almost frail. And yeah, so people were coming after him. So we felt like we needed like a presence, and this kid just fit the bill. Like he was a big physical kid who was who Patrick and him were good friends, and he needed puck skills. Like he was a big kid and he hit everybody and he was intimidating. He was very mature physically for his age. And we were like, maybe this could fit. Like Patrick needs somebody to kind of ride shotgun to create some space. And this guy needs puck skills. And Patrick needed to be able to play off of someone. Like he used to just get the puck and walk around everybody and literally stick handle it across the goal line to score most of his goals. And so we were trying to get him to play a little bit more give and go and utilize this kid. So it was a bit of a match where one kid needed one thing and the other kid needed another. And when we put them together, you know, both kids had a chance to really get a lot.
One of my favorite parts about Patrick's forward was kind of resembling what you're saying, where he would be dancing around some guys and you used a game where they were up 5-1 and Patrick is dangling around the defenseman and he scores a goal. What was the importance of using that as a teaching moment? Because you said you benched him for the rest of the game and he sat next to you. And the importance of also doing that on a high note, right? Like, not that when they were losing and not to really like crush the kid's confidence at the time, using that opportunity to say, hey, you know, I'm sure it was a great play, but also you have to utilize your teammates.
So we were in the throes of this process of utilizing other people. Like, we were right dug into it, and we had set up like power plays where he was like on the half wall and he's distributing, and that was the goal. So we go, you know, 2-3 weeks in preparation for a tournament. We have the power play set up. We have all these things about him, you know, moving to space, getting it back. Then we get in the game. And he's back to, you know, beat the first guy, beat the second guy, probably beat the first guy again, and then walk the goalie and score. And I'm like, Patrick, you have to use your teammates. We worked on it on the power play. We've worked on it everywhere. You got to start doing it. And if you don't start doing it, I'm going to have to start doing something. And so we got to this point in the game where I could tell, like, we were up 5-1, but he hadn't scored. So I knew it was coming, that he was going to be like, I'm going to get the score sheet and I'm going to just take it upon myself to do it. And I was warning him beforehand. I'm like, if you do it one more time, you're sitting beside me. So I remember him, I knew it. And then my buddy Bud said, he's going to go, like, he's just going to do it. And I said, you got to follow through. So I said, oh, I will. So he did. He, you know, beat the first guy, beat the second guy, goes in, scores, and he comes back to the bench. I said, that's it. You're done. And I don't think he believed I would do it like that. Like, to your point, was like, after I'm scoring a goal, like, what's wrong with scoring? And I said, it's not the fact that you scored. It's that this goal is not projectable. Yes, we're in a 5-1 game. We're better than this team. They've probably long since given up. So yeah, of course you can score there, but what happens when we play against the really good teams and now they're trying to take your head off? Like, this attitude and this play is just not going to work. So that was a real turning point for him and for me with him, because he definitely started to change a lot of the things and started to look at the game a little differently after that.
The relationship with Bud is interesting in this book, as far as how he kind of he handled some of the other things that a coach does and kind of let you do your thing and stay in your lane. What was your, as you approached practice back then, like what was your thought process like going into a practice? Was it up tempo? What were you trying to achieve with each practice?
Initially, we were attracting some of the best players in the area to our practices and to our training sessions, because I was generating a lot of pace. So when people came out, it was high energy, high intensity. We're up and down the sheet flying. It was like 9-1-1, go right from the start. And that was why those kids were coming initially. And then I started to look at it and say, well, I'm not really teaching them anything. Like, we got them flying and they're passing like what I called like the sweat test, but we weren't really teaching them. So I was trying to figure out different ways. And you got to remember, like, I was learning too. I was learning my own skills. Like, I didn't really have an extensive playing background, as I said. So I'm trying to learn how to teach, but handle the puck and try different things. So there really wasn't much of I was like herding cats most of the time, but not really imparting anything. And I felt like I needed to do that. So as time went on, I started to look at different types of ideas of how I could continue to push the pace or manipulate the pace, like maybe have it start slower, start building, like teaching something, and then ramp it up to a high rate of speed and then come down, teach something else. And so I started to have these more practice peaks that I was looking to build towards. It was really an experimental stage during that time, for sure, where I was trying to do a variety of different things. And I was trying to be the pace, like be the person that was the intensity. Like I was intense, so it drove them. And then Bud would say to me all the time, he'd say, at some point, you're going to have to turn this over to the kids. Like they're going to have to drive the pace. And you're going to have to find ways to allow them to do that. They're not going to do it on their own. You have to create that environment. So just learn. And, but he wouldn't tell me how. I had to figure it out on my own and try different things. Well, that worked. This didn't work. That worked. So it was very experimental between me and the kids. And Bud was like the person that was driving both of us. He would drive the kids through me. And his job was to try to, he felt his job was to try to teach me, but I was like his student. And he was kind of the quote assistant coach for the kids. So it was really a fascinating dynamic.
How have your methods evolved since then? Obviously, as you're, you know, you're going to practice one way with the kids, but you're going to practice a different way with when you're, you know, have Patrick now and these elite NHL athletes. And also how do you balance instilling some individualistic traits without interfering with the team structure, because obviously teams play different ways.
Yeah. So like the first point I evolved, like now, like what I found was when we were, when as in my evolution was there's really three key relationships that go on as part of teaching. There's my relationship with the player. There's the player's relationship with the content that I'm trying to teach them. And then there's my relationship with the content that I'm trying to teach them. So what's my background knowledge surrounding what it is that I'm trying to teach? How fluent am I in what I'm trying to teach them? And what's my relationship with that skill in terms of where I'm at and how fluent I am in being able to impart that knowledge? And then what's my relationship with that player? Like, how can I leverage my relationship with the player? Is it a new relationship? Is it an existing relationship? And that all weighs into it, how hard I can push, what I can see with the success rates and how much failure I can build in. Like that relationship is really important. And then the player's relationship with the skill, like how much background knowledge do they have around the skill? Is this something new? Is it a habit we're trying to change? What's the context around that? And so interweaving that dynamic is really where it evolves. And that's really the balance or the checks and balances that I work through every day as it relates to them. And what I'm ultimately trying to become is a co-teacher. That's ultimate. I'm trying to bring this relationship with between me, the player, and the skill to where I'm teaching it to them, they're teaching it to me, and the skill is presenting itself with multiple challenges. So that's kind of where it's at. As it relates to the team and not interfering with team dynamics, that's where the research comes in. So we're very, I think, very well researched on each individual player that we work with. And we work on the number of instances in which they have in a certain situation and what those success rates are. So if you took Patrick, for example, you know, off the rush, he's going to get several opportunities off the rush. And many of those, he's going to use a delay and he's going to pull up and make a play. So that allows him to play with expectation. I know I'm going to get a certain number, maybe it's 6, 8, 10 of these a night. And of those 6, 8, 10, 65 to 70% of these, I'm going to turn into a delay. Okay. So that now, you know, how many of those you're going to get. And now we also know what the success rate is. How many of these are you going to be able to convert into chances to score? So now if there's an inefficiency in that, of how many successes you're actually able to produce, that's my area of opportunity. It's already what they're doing. It's not like, well, he gets 6 or 8 of these delay opportunities a game, but maybe he should be on the other side of the ice. He'd be better if he was on the other side of the ice, or maybe he shouldn't delay at all. Maybe he should do something else. It's less about that. It's more, this is what you already do. This is what your success rate is in those areas. So how can we become more successful in what you do? I think where you run into trouble as a skills coach is when you start taking them out of what they would normally do And now you're infringing upon perhaps patterns of play that are driven by the team. And so I avoid all of that by trying to stick to the things that they do most frequently.
Patrick's made it a point to try to bring down line mates to Florida periodically the last few summers to develop chemistry and probably implement some of the things that you're working individually with him, with the rest of the guys that he potentially would be playing with during the season. That's been a revolving door, as you well know. How important is it to at times get who his line mates are or who he could potentially be playing with a lot to work with him, with you, and kind of develop a rapport?
So initially it was, here's who I expect to play with a lot, or here's who I did play with a lot before. And maybe there's other things that we can be taking a look at to become more in sync. That's initially what we thought when we first started bringing them down. And we had all these other players that were coming in as well. And he just thought it would be a great kickstart to the season, something unique. How it actually played out was it was less about creating like line chemistry and that sort of thing, and became more about inviting the players that are on his team into his world and be able to share ideas freely so that they could understand how each other thinks and have a playground before the season starts to go through some of those thought processes and kind of understand, like, in this situation, I like to do this. And so then, and this is how you may apply yourself in these situations, or what are your thoughts? Or here's an area where you like to go a lot. Like, what are you thinking in these areas? And then also hear the context of the rest of the group. You have some pretty special players down there. Now they're there with them. So, you know, one year we had like DeBrincat down there, which was great, but he's also there with Claude Giroux. He's there with, you know, Matt Barzal. He's there with, like, these are interesting players with interesting dynamics that he's now picking up information from those guys. As much as he was down there to be with Patrick, he was also picking up information from everyone. So, like I said, initially it was like, yeah, let's bring him down. Let's build some chemistry. This is going to be great. And then once we're there, it's like, wait a minute, there's a lot more benefits, and we've sold this maybe short of what potentially could be, and maybe we should just let it organically play out. That's what we did.
And to that point, one of the things that you introduced a few years ago, and I think you took it from football, was having the player stand up in the room with the rest of the guys there and narrate one of their own plays and kind of take the group through the mental process that, in this case, Patrick Kane was approaching. And so what is that like when you're in that room and you're watching, you know, one elite player talk to another 10 elite, and you see kind of the wheels spinning in everybody?
It's like the closest thing you'll get to like collective genius, right? It's like one person stands up and describes their genius or their, the things that they do well and the way in which they think, which is really what makes them special. I mean, you get to that level, the difference individual skill wise between different players can be very, like, much smaller than you might think. It's the way they think and the application of skill and the use of skill to create tactical advantage. That's where the separation comes in, and use of assets, like the ability to use what they do well or what areas that they have that are unique to them, how they apply that. So you get one player talking like that, and then the other players start chiming in about, well, in that situation, like, I would be focused on this part of the play, or if in my situation, I'd be focused on this. So what was interesting was, like, if it was Patrick standing up and he's talking, he would describe his situation, then it goes to the group, and then you'd hear a guy saying, well, I think the most important part of this play is the guy on the far side, like, he's just coming into the screen just now. That guy is really important. And other, you can see other players go, oh yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of it like that. Or the handedness of the defenseman you're going against created such an opportunity. And the guy's like, well, wait a minute, the handedness, that might not be something that I've really considered before. That's interesting. And so it becomes this, and we did it like on a given night that we did this, or we started off, it was like five or six of these guys would get up and describe in great detail what they're talking about. It just fostered so much excitement and discussion. And then where it became even more interesting was when we went on the ice the next day. Cause then now they start taking some of those, hey, I know you were talking about that. Walk me through that here. Like, what are you thinking about with this? Or how would my body position be? And it becomes a collaboration amongst them. And just fascinating stuff. Yeah. It's a situation where the teacher who's supposed to be me, I literally just like, it's like the Homer Simpson with the meme where he slides back into the bush. Yeah. That's me. Just literally like, okay, I'm here. Oh, no, this isn't for me. I'm just going to step back. And you literally step back and just let it go. Because there's certainly nothing I'm going to add to that discussion that's going to make it better than what they would do organically on their own.
It's so crazy when you talk about the handedness, because I feel like those athletes, when they recognize the situation where somebody's on his offhand, or it, like, it's subconscious to them, right? Like, they're not even thinking about it in the moment. So when I first heard that story, I thought it was incredible. One of the things you wrote in the book is you'll send your clients clips every 3 to 5 games. Can you give us an example of what you might share in there, and what does that look like?
Yeah, it's let's say the player's on a 3-game segment process. So after the 3 games are played, we analyze them, and we analyze them from an instance rate perspective. So how many instances did you have of the various things in which you do? And what are the highest frequency situations you're putting yourself in the most? And what is the success rate of those things? And how is that in line with what you're historically normally going to do? And then if it's any kind of variation, then we would discuss habit changes that are leading to greater successes, or habit changes that are leading to less of a success rate, and discussing different plays and ideas that surround how to improve those success rates, whether it could be, you know, maybe it's something that they're doing in the offensive zone that it's really a habit that is influencing it that could have been done in the neutral zone. The way in which they used the space in the neutral zone may have either helped them or hurt them as it relates to time and space and opportunity to be able to attack. So it's a lot of discussion about those things. And it's me merely just pointing out discussion ideas that come to the player as things that they might think about and start trying going forward. Cause you got to remember these types of players, they have the benefit of expectation. So the benefit of expectation means they know these things are going to happen multiple times a game. So when you do it the first time and you miss an opportunity, well, you know, you're going to get another one. So they have the benefit of expectation that another one is coming, and they can approach it differently. Maybe they shoulder check to get their vision a little earlier, which now they can read the space, or they recognize the handedness of the person, or a weak stick is available, or whatever. Because every play, the problem is they look alike, but they're a lot like fingerprints, right? Like, they're still unique in a certain way, like the pressure, the support, it's all different just a little bit. So, but by and large, your habits and the way you create them are similar. And so it's just a matter of allowing them to have a couple of ideas that could lead them down a path of greater success that they can start thinking about. So when they get these situations recurring, that they can make their own adjustments, or that there's an adjustment that I can put in their head that they could contemplate for the next rep. If that video makes any sense at all.
No, it does. It totally makes sense. And video's a big part of your development process. Where does analytics fall into that? Do you meld that together? And like with the clients you have, do you have a staff of a few people that are, you're able to watch a few different games, break it down? All right, let's get this off to Barzell. Let's get this off to Kane.
Yes.
And then you talk to them on the back end. Just take us through that.
Yeah, we have let's start with the analytics question. The way analytics are done now is very different than the way we utilize analytics. I don't really talk a lot about like shot generation or shot metrics and things like that, or possession metrics. Like, that stuff is excellent from a diagnostic perspective, but is not all that illuminating to me as it relates to the practical application. So you could tell me that the player is not generating enough shots for the time in which he's on the ice, but that doesn't really tell me anything actionable. So I have my own analytics that I have to do that is much more, for me, more actionable as it relates to that individual player. So our metrics and the things in which we talk about would be very different than what would be publicly available for analytics. And it's not to say that those analytics are not right, because they are, and they're very illuminating for other things. Just for the purposes that I'm doing it for, it's not all that. So I don't use that type of analytics because it's not as illuminating individually. And the other thing too is I'm looking for repeated instances. So I want a list of instances that are not only have a numerical value, but also have a list of clips. So if there's 10 instances, I need 10 video clips that are also associated with that. So I can go through and take the common things that come out of that to be able to talk to my clients about. Those are things that I think are really important as it relates to analytics. And the second part of your question was, sorry.
Just the process of your staff and sending it out. Oh, yeah. and then gathering, and then talking to the client once they've digested it.
Yeah. I have a staff, and their job is to create these lists. Effectively, we have our own system that we built, and it collects these lists of, it gives me a number, and each number is associated with a video clip. And that video clip gives me a list of things that I want to see. So if I wanted to see every shot generated from the slot or from the off the rush, off the pass, I have access to that. And now give me all of them for not only those three games or five games, I could get all of them for the whole season. So I want things in the lists, instances in the list, because I'm looking for common situations with uncommon things or different ways in which a player approached it that are going to give us ideas on how to take more control over space, or how the player allowed the defender to take control of the space in that situation, and why, and what could be, and what they could do to prevent those things, to improve their success rates in those areas.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angi to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angi app or visit Angi.com today. You can do this when you Angi that.
Does your communication level or the amount of communication change when your clients are in the playoffs? Like with Patrick, do you communicate with him more frequently, maybe on like a more game by game basis? And like, one of my favorite things about Patrick and watching Patrick is he averaged a point per game in the playoffs, but I'm sure if you ask him, he felt like he could have produced more. Like what did you see from him, and what was your, you know, your thoughts on his play, like your communication wise too?
So during the season, we do every three games because the opponent is different, of course. Very few times you're going to play, you're never going to play back to back against the same opponent. So you're getting a new opponent all the time as you go. And so once you get to the playoffs, of course, you're playing the same guy, same opponent, and you're likely playing the same matchup against the same people or similar people, depending on the coaching strategy. So our communication can go game to game. It just depends on the player might ask questions like, hey, like, I just feel like there's, you know, there's no space, or where can I get the puck more? I don't feel like I'm in as much rhythm. And then we can go through that. But we know that whatever discussions we're going to have about that, that's going to be sustainable throughout the whole seven games or however long that this series goes. So yes, the communication gets more, more condensed once the playoffs come. And a lot of times it's athlete driven, or if I see something, I'll of course send them a video, but I'm not, it's not the same. Like when we send the initial ones, it's like 12 to 15 minutes and it's on a variety of different subjects that we know are important to the player. Once you get to the playoffs, it's like one thing. This one thing could potentially be helpful for you as it relates to perhaps a matchup, like this defenseman that you're going against, this is how he's trying to play you. And these are ways in which you can control that, take more control over that situation more effectively. Or here's some ideas on how to do that. Or, you know, you're getting pushed to the outside, or you're not getting the puck as often. How can we get the puck more? What other ideas? And here's some clips on the last game in which you could have got the puck more, but perhaps moved in a different way. And it just provides some thought on how to get those situations to become more effective, because the turnaround so quickly to the next game.
The summer camps, you know, there's elite players that come to Florida, and they're special beasts in themselves, and they're at the top of their profession and they want to get better. And they're willing to even share, I don't want to say trade secrets, but they're willing to share some of their genius with the other geniuses in the room. Is there any proprietary information like that you, when you're dealing with Sid and Austin and Patrick, that you kind of have to say, all right, well, like summer's its own thing, but like in season, things are different. These two teams may be playing each other in a week. How free flowing, I guess, is the information you share amongst your clients?
Not as free flowing as you might think. Like it's more, like the problem is the players are so unique. Each one of them has different things. They're going to ask questions regarding another player on their application of skill through their assets and how what they do is interesting that perhaps how, but they know they couldn't necessarily adopt that entirely into their own game because they're a different type of player. They're set up differently. So for example, like if you look at like Patrick came out of the last one that we had last year, and he just loved and had so much respect for Matt Barzal coming out of there. And he's talked about it several times, just how much he just really loves the way Matt plays and some of the things that he does. But Matt's a centerman. Patrick is a left shot, right winger. So they inherently get the puck in completely different spots on the ice. But the way in which they control the feet of the defender, or how Barzal approaches certain situations, is interesting. Now, Pat would not adopt what Barzal does entirely, but he's provided him with some ideas as to how, but then how does he apply his skill? Obviously, Patrick's a little different skater than Barzal. So how does his, like Barzal's, the way he moves and his skating ability offers him areas of the ice that other people just can't get into, including Patrick. But then there's some things that he does that maybe Patrick could take a look at and say, you know what, that's something that's interesting. So it's less about trade secrets necessarily, like, oh, I notice you do this, or, hey, what's your secret on how this works? And more like, you do this a unique way. I think that might fit nicely into my game in this area, or gives me some ideas, but your asset base is different than mine. So now I got to try to figure out how, like, how I could take maybe a couple of those ideas and mix them with some of the other things that I normally do that's going to enhance my overall skill set. So it's more like that than a trick or a thing. Because the other thing you have to remember is these players are scouting each other. Like, if you ask any of them, they'll tell you, I have a favorite player, I watch every one of his games. Like, they'll tell you, like, I watch this guy all the time. I think he's interesting. I like how he plays. I'm entertained by him. And when I have a chance, I always go back and try to watch that player. But they don't watch highlights. They watch games. They're wanting to see habits and patterns and things like that. So there's no real secrets. Like, these guys are watching each other. They're highly scouted by the teams. There's no real secrets. The idea is more like, what kinds of things do you have that are unique to you that may be something that gives me an idea of an area that I may not have thought about before? And then how does that work with me? And my job in that process is like the conversion process. Well, Barzal's a center, so he gets the puck here. You're a right shot, left, or left shot, right winger. You get the puck here. Here's how he uses his feet. Here's how you use your feet. These are the way he uses his puck or where he puts the puck. This part might be interesting to you. The rest of him may, rest of it may not apply. Gives Patrick now some idea of the kinds of things that he might start taking a look at and exploring on his own.
It's been so cool to watch Patrick's game evolve into more of a complete, like, offensive player. And reading the book, it's funny that when he was younger, all he wanted to do is score goals, right? And then he gets to the NHL, and he was so pass heavy. Like, I remember his first several years, he was always looking to make the pass. And even in a 2-on-1 situation in 2000, I don't know, like 12, 13, 14, he started to become more of a 50-50 shot pass, like on a 2-on-1 opportunity. Were you behind that? Or, like, how did he evolve it to realizing that, oh, I could be more dangerous if they know that the pass isn't coming, that I have the threat of the shot?
So there was a year, and forgive me, I'm not great with the dates of which year it is, but there was a year where Patrick got hurt in January, and it ended his season. He was leading the league in scoring at that time before he got injured. And it was that time where he was consistently, like, he was going on 12, 15, 20 game scoring, like, stretches where it was every game he was consistently scoring, and you could see its effect on winning, and you could see its effect on the rest of the team. You could see its effect on their ability to, at that time, they were moving Taves away from Kane and trying to create multiple lines, and Kane was playing then with different players. And while he was doing this, he was leading the league in scoring. So he was like, they moved him away from Kane, and yet even still, he was still able to lead the league in scoring at that time. So then it became, well, obviously I have the talent to put myself in a position to be in January where I could effectively win a scoring title here. But what's the pathway? Like, what is that pathway? And what's the effect it's going to have on the rest of my team if I was able to do that? What does that do? And so Patrick at that point was scoring, you know, 20, 25 goals in and around there every year. You could pretty much put him in the bank for 20, 25 goals, but he wasn't scoring, like, he wasn't ripping the puck from 30 feet to score these goals. They were different types of goals. So the process to lead, so when we take a look at, if you want to lead the league in scoring, there really isn't anybody doing that that doesn't score 40 goals. You pretty much have to score 40 to lead the league in scoring. So now you got to find, Patrick got to find 15 goals somewhere, somehow, like, where are these 15 goals coming from? So yes, you have to improve your shot. And it took a couple of years to kind of get that in there. But more importantly, like, the physical improving the shot is one thing. It's a mental part of it. What is the true value for a pass first guy who knows, like, I'm going to be here, I can make all these, thread the needle, find these guys. What's the real value of me shooting? Like, if I'm scoring more, what's the impact of that going to have on the rest of my game? Like, am I going to drop in assists, or like, how's that going to work? And what Patrick found was he became this dual threat that made his passing so much more effective. So in order to become a better passer, when you think about him in his first 4 or 5 years, what does he do? He's already saucing the puck over a stick, through skates, threading a needle, backdoor passes. Like, what more could he do on his passing? Like, his passing was so elite. He could find guys. Like, he was finding guys on the weak side. It was like, where's, you go through the replay, the guy he's passing to isn't even in the screen yet, and he's found him. Like, that kind of, so it's not vision. It's not that kind of stuff. It's like, no, if you're a threat, people now have to play you differently. The defender's now playing you more honestly. He's trying to, you know, defend this shot. The goalie's got to play you honestly. So now when you pass it to the other guy, he's getting a much more, the goalie's not getting a jump on this pass to create this save for you. You're a legitimate threat. Or you could threaten like you're going to pass, and all of a sudden shoot. And you could see in that time, he scored a lot of no look goals where he's looking at the passer, pass the guy he potentially could pass to, and then he shoots while he's not even looking at the net. And he developed those types of like dual threat, or I'm presenting a shot, I'm looking like I'm going to shoot. And then all of a sudden at the last second, I know because everything is collapsing for that shot. Now when I pass, it's an empty net for the next guy. So it just rounded out his offensive game where he became so deceptive. And then you add that to an already a gifted passer. It just took everything to a whole nother platform.
I think he talked to Nathan MacKinnon about the number of touches ideally he'd like to have in a game. And it was something like 40. And do you know, I mean, where he's at as far as like last year, last couple of years, how many touches does he average roughly per game?
He gets a lot of puck touches. We put 40 as a goal because early on in his career, we noticed a pattern between multiple point productions games and this number of 40 or 40 plus puck touches. And so what we were looking at was, okay, obviously that's a number. So how do you get the puck 40 times? Like, how can we get it this up? And that's even strength, which is incredibly difficult. It's a very high number, 40 possessions. And then we switched our tracking. We stopped talking about just an individual isolation of accounting a puck touch. And we now track it by sequence. So it's not now 40 puck touches. It's how many pucks, how many times you can get a puck in a multiple puck sequence. So you're on a breakout, you catch a puck. If Kane's going to get it on a breakout, he's going to find the weak side D. He sprints up the ice. The weak side D makes a play. Next thing you know, the puck goes cross ice back to Kane for an entry. So that's two puck touches. Now he gets in the zone. What's he going to do? He drives the guy deep, maybe a little deception to the inside. Now he's going to pull up in a delay. And I know you guys can see this because this happens like multiple times a game. And now he turns into his delay. Once he finds his delay, now he finds a guy, maybe like the weak side D, or he finds someone on the backside. Now there's a shot generated. Well, Patrick's already on that side. He comes downhill. Now he gets a puck, maybe a loose puck in the corner. Now he climbs up the wall like he normally does. And now he's making like interior passes, or he rolls over the top because the D dives down. Now he comes over the top in the middle. Well, now we're up to like 4 or 5 puck touches in a single team possession sequence in which every puck is kind of like coming through him. And he is like the architect or decision maker of what's going on. That's where we're at now. We used to be on individual puck touches because we felt like that was important. Now we're talking about quality of pucks, because when you track the game in sequence like that, the interesting part about it is the first puck touch is usually contested in some way. The NHL is a highly contested situation on first puck touches. So when you first touch it, or the team I'm talking about, the first possession, the other team had it, and now it's your first puck touch. It's likely going to be a forced turnover where you had to physically take the puck off somebody, or it's some type of a contested 50-50 in which you had to win a puck. That's not exactly a great puck to use to generate offense off of. So you need to be able to problem solve that puck to be able to make a play to somebody else that they can get it off the pass. Now they get it off the pass. The probability of that player being able to make a play to someone else off the pass is much higher, of course. So you're trying to gradually improve the quality of the puck touch that you're giving someone else in an effort to be able to get a quality puck touch back, because he wants the puck off the pass because it's easier to generate offense off the pass, because you're, the probability of being able to have time, space, opportunity to attack is obviously way higher when you have such a thing. So his priority is not to get less loose pucks or compete for less loose pucks. His job is to problem solve those pucks, give the puck to someone who has a little bit of time and space in which they can continue the possession so that perhaps he can get it again, because the probability of him having a much more favorable possession on the second or third puck touch is way higher. Now you think about Pat Kane open space on his off wing. That is about as, that's about as scary a proposition for the opposition as anything. So our priority is now, how can you get this puck multiple times? What are you doing to give yourself the best probability of being able to get the puck back? And what kind of pucks are you giving somebody else that gives them more of an opportunity? So now it's totally evolved into that type of thing. And now the other factor is, and you can't be scared to shoot. Because now when you think of these possessions, you think, oh, okay, well, obviously this is pass. It's like loose puck or forced turnover turns into four passes, shot. No, that's not how it works. It can be loose puck retrieval to a pass. The pass goes to another shot, puck recovery. Now it's on the, now it's another pass. Then it's another shot. So now you've generated three or four shots in the team sequence, and you're not scared to shoot, but you're getting the puck multiple times. This is the kind of stuff now that we feel really important as it relates to Patrick's game.
Daryl, I don't know if I'm going to be able to watch a Blackhawks game without hearing your voice in my head and counting the puck touches of Patrick Kane's line mates.
I think it's you won't be the first one to be poisoned by my way of watching the game. You won't watch it the same way again. And hopefully it's for the better and not for the worse. But when you see this, you'll know what I'm talking about. And like, he's not going to be denied getting pucks. And now he's in a situation where he's going to play with multiple players in a week, let alone a season. They're, you know, the where the Blackhawks are, they're changing. They're looking to try to find the right fit. And Patrick can drive a line. He can drive offense through a line, and he can have different types of players. And it's a real challenge for him to be able to find, you know, you come out the first period, you play with two guys, and there's a certain way in which those two guys like to play that's going to impact the types of pucks you get. Now you come out, you know, late in the first, there's a change or there's something else. And now maybe they put Toews and Kane back together for a little while, and then they split them back up, and now it's something different. Like, he could have multiple line mates over the course of a game, a week, a month. He could play with most of the top nine he could play with in the entire month. So each guy has different assets and different things and ways and habits that he has of himself that factor it. And we haven't even talked about the D, who Patrick loves to use the D. We haven't even talked about them. Of how, what impact those players have. Like, he had Gustafsson for a long time he was playing with, and they had tremendous chemistry. Now Gustafsson's gone, all of a sudden they got all these different players that he's now playing with, that he's got to figure out, can he get the puck from the D the same way he was getting it from that guy? These are big challenges that are fascinating to work through, but yet still maintain your output.
All right, Daryl, last one for you. We had Patrick's trainer, Ian Mack, on the podcast recently, And he said that Patrick could play till he's 50. Maybe there's a little hyperbole there, but nobody knows him better than you. You've been with him since he was nine. You know the dedication he has, the total commitment, the total buy-in, whether it's nutrition, how he handles his training sessions, the extra miles he goes in the off season to prepare for an upcoming season. How long do you think Patrick can play at an elite level?
Well, I think Patrick can play as long as Patrick wants to play. And I don't disagree with Ian in the sense that, like, putting out a number like that, that on the surface sounds like, well, this is completely ridiculous or absurd. I don't disagree. And here's the reasons why. Patrick's entire game is built on efficiency of movement. His entire way in which he plays is based on efficiency. It's not as difficult for him to move around the rink as it is for most other players. So he has that as a major asset. And Ian has done a tremendous job of making a guy who is already silky smooth, even more silky smooth in the way in which he did. The other thing is he takes less toll on his body because you can't hit him. You can't hit him. You haven't been able to hit him for years. Like he takes a significant, even though he touches the puck all this time, most players, they touch the puck 40 times. You might need a body bag because the guy is getting hit so many times. He's doing this. He gets a puck. He moves it. He moves to space. He gets it back. His greatest asset is two things. Number one, his mind. He is a brilliant, brilliant hockey player. He sees it. The game in such a slow motion. He sees all the pieces. He knows where everything is. So that's number one. And his efficiency of movement is another asset that makes it take. And the other thing is he's highly competitive. And so you take a highly competitive guy who's very efficient in his movement, where it's a game's almost too easy for him to move around in, who has an elite commitment to fitness and efficiency of movement and the way he takes care of his body. And then you combine that with his mind. I'm not going to bet against him. He just has too many things. And then you combine that with his ability to adapt. He can adapt to different line mates. He can adapt to different situations. He's played with the best players in the game. He's also played with guys of whom he's had to really find a way to produce with that are not you would consider to be offensive geniuses, but they're still good players. Every player in the NHL is a good player, but he's had to find a way to adapt, and he's done that. So you got a guy who can adapt. That's the hardest thing to do in the NHL is to adapt to different situations, because most players are restricted by their situation. It's very difficult to overcome your situation, the line matchup that you're against and the line that you're out there with. It is a major factor as to whether or not you're going to be successful by and large. Like when you take a large sample size, it's very difficult to overcome that. Patrick has shown an ability to do that. And when you combine it with the other things that I'm factoring in, you take a guy like Ian Mack, who has an ability to build a body in a certain way. I don't know if I can bet against him. I don't know if I can.
Well, we see why you've been with him for so long. This was a tremendous education for Charlie and myself. If you ever have a pro camp for hockey writers or talking heads on TV, Charlie and I will be on the first flight down to Florida to take part in it, because it'd be a hell of an education for us.
You know what? You may have given me an idea. You just never know.
I'm signing up now.
Love it. Love it. It's just, you know, when you start talking about play, and the reason I love this, and after having written the book, of course, is largely about, you know, my teaching experience and how to become a more effective teacher. But as we've gotten through some of the media of it, it's given an unexpected platform to talk about kind of unique things that are things that you could look for in the game that are maybe like people don't talk about very often that are really interesting as it relates to these types of players and the opportunity to talk about my relationship with Patrick and, you know, the way he is and how he thinks has been an unexpected true privilege to be able to kind of get into that, because I think that, you know, a lot more people might see the game slightly different or appreciate some of these other nuances, which enriches the experience for everyone.
Well, thanks again for doing this. Good luck with the book, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Daryl.
Our thanks to Daryl Belfry for joining us. Again, his new book is Belfry Hockey, Strategies to Teach the World's Best Athletes, available wherever you get your favorite books. That is going to do it for this edition of the Blackhawks Talk Podcast. For Charlie Romeliotis, I'm Pat Boyle. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate us, and we'll catch you next time.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.